Hi, Small Subjects listeners. We want to hear from you. Click on the link on the blog where we post photos from each episode, www.boxdioramas.com/smallsubjects, or on our social media posts, and comment on anything we've said in this or any episode, or pose a question you'd like to hear us answer.
There's no time limit, but please try to focus your comments because we'd love to include them in full on the show. Thanks.
Hello, Small Subject listeners. It's Chris again from Inside the Armor Publications. First, the big news. Models for Ukraine Volume 2 is now available as an ebook. You no longer have to pay a large shipping cost to go to the US or customs to get your book in the EU. You can download it directly from www.insidethearmor.com. That's not all, of course. We still have the extremely popular Perfect Pits ebook and a bunch of other great stuff, including Wingsy Kits, Tetra Model, and of course our superb print publications. You can also express your interest for the new book coming out via the website. The new book, titled Heroim Slavar, details the building of the large diorama that I recently took to Scale Model Challenge, featuring 4 destroyed tanks and 7 scratch-built figures. It also includes reference material previously unpublished direct from Ukraine. So please do head on over to InsideTheArmor.com today. Now back to Jim and Barry for the best conversation in Scale Model Podcasting.
Welcome to Small Subjects, Big Ideas About Miniatures and Modeling. I'm Jim DeRogatis in Chicago.
And I'm Barry Biediger in Salt Lake City.
It was good to see you recently, Barry, in person at the 48th annual MMSI Chicago show. It was your shortest visit here ever, though.
I think it was, yeah, that we had to leave on the train early on Sunday and because we had to take the box that I bought from Joe back. Shep's box.
Ghost of Hamlet's father.
Yeah, that's right.
I know you were very worried about transporting it safely, but it arrived in Utah unscathed, yes?
We got back to Salt Lake, and the box is in the same shape as it was when we left, so.
Yeah. Hey, were you in the same shape? I know the train ride didn't quite agree with you.
It was, I had some motion sickness issues, which I'm extremely susceptible to that, but after a while, I kind of got my train legs, if that's a thing, like sea legs, and it got better.
I remember that. We took a train ride in Europe from Paris to go to the expo in Montreux, and both you and Shep were having a hard time the whole time. I felt like I was a frontline medic.
That train ride from Montreux back to Paris was swaying back and forth, and it was probably close to the temperature where you can melt aluminum inside the train. It was really hot, and I was really sick the entire way. Yeah.
Okay. Well, note to anyone in the future, take good care when moving Barry from point A to B.
Right.
As good care as you would take of a Shep Payne box. So we are...
Well, hold on. Enough about me, though. Yeah. So do you feel any different now?
We're going to talk about the MMSI show, like, after our featured guest this week.
Okay, so we're just going to... we're just going to keep it a mystery, okay.
Yeah, we'll just keep it a mystery for a bit. Lot, various and sundry, to talk about the show and a bunch of other stuff. Plus, I'm going to introduce a new feature.
Uh-oh.
Which I haven't told you about.
No. But before you do that, let me ask one question.
Yeah.
Are you going to tease me any less about these titles you give me?
No.
Oh, great.
No, none whatsoever, because you're the MFCA Grandmaster Wizard. And that's about that is the highest honor one can get in the United States in modeling, in our branch of modeling. And I think, until you become a world master at the next expo in Versailles in 2025, I just have to keep milking MFCA for you.
Well, that's not going to happen. I'm never going to be a world master. So
you never know. Nobody understands your work, and so therefore,
it must be good.
Either they'll completely overlook it or give it an award because we don't get this guy, but we know he's good.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
Yeah. Either way, could go either way for you. So
fair enough. But your new feature though. What? My, is...
Oh no! It's a surprise. It's going to come later.
Okay. Yeah.
So, Bob Sarnowski is a friend of both of ours. He's one of our most loyal listeners after Pat Vess. As soon as like the episode goes up, 2 hours later, we get comments from Bob, comments from Pat. But Pat calls to deliver them invariably at the most inconvenient time, although we love listening to Pat anytime. Bob is just such a self-effacing and quiet fellow, but he's always been one of the most inspiring members of the MMSI club to me as a painter, as someone who keeps expanding his knowledge base. After decades as an award-winning figure painter, you know, Bob's doing armor and Bob's doing, printing at home, 3D printing. Yeah. And he's an amazing photographer. All those wonderful images from the Chicago show and from every Chicago show going back except the 1 year when one of his kids got married, from World Expo 2017, are Bob Sarnowski's. And so we had a lot of different things to talk to him about, and I don't think we should delay. We should dive right in.
Okay.
Well, we are excited to have Bob Sarnowski on Small Subjects. No fewer than three broad topics of interest, Bob, that we've been eager to talk to you about.
Yeah, okay.
Bob is self-effacing to a fault, Barry, not unlike you. And I think he's
I like him. Yeah.
I know. We love Bob. And he's like, I don't think I have anything to talk about. That's not true, Bob. We love to start with every guest about how you got into this odd little hobby of ours.
Yeah, well, I guess like everybody else, it started with models, right? As a kid growing up, I always liked to build models with my dad. My brother-in-law was really into model building, so I kind of grew up building models with him. Then as I got older, I remember going to a hobby shop. This was when I was living in Chicago. Went to a hobby shop in South Holland. And the guy says, you ought to come to this IPMS meeting. We have a guest speaker. I'm like, yeah, all right. So I went, and the guest speaker turned out to be Shep Payne.
Mm.
So
we honest, know that name.
Yeah. Honestly, before that, I'm shameful to admit I never really heard of Shep. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So they were passing around his book, the diorama book, and I'm looking at these pictures and I'm like, man, this guy's pretty darn good. He does stuff with models that I'd never seen done before. So then, he did his little talk and he mentioned the MMSI, Military Miniature Society of Illinois, and that they were going to have a show in October. So I went, looked, walked into the exhibit room, and it's the first time I had ever seen figures like this painted and mounted on by themselves. They were always usually with a tank or an airplane or something. And I was just hooked from then. From then on, I bought my first figure there, painted it up. It turned out pretty good, at least that's what I thought. But then there was a sign right before I left. It said Shep Payne figure painting class.
Mm.
And I took his number, and I was out of work at the time. The steel mills were kind of going downhill. So I was talking to my wife and I says, $80 for this course is kind of a lot of money. And this was back in January of 81. This was after the October 80 show. So anyway, long story short, I took the class, did the 6 weeks, and been a member of the club ever since.
That's fantastic.
Cool. Yeah, the early 80s was not the best time for the steel industry, was it?
No, late 70s, early 80s. My last time there was in June of 81. And then once I was laid off, I just never went back.
Yeah.
Our lives have always intersected, Bob, because Carmel, my wife, grew up, you know, in the shadow of the steel mills down on the far southeast side of Chicago. And then did you go right from there to the Chicago Tribune?
Nope. I stayed home and I watched our daughter for about 6 or 7 months while my wife went back to work. Mm. Then in January, I went downtown and I applied at the Chicago Tribune. So put in my application there. They were building a new printing plant, the Freedom Center on Chicago and Halsted at the time. Mm-hmm. So I put in my application there in January, late January. And I didn't hear anything back from them all summer. So I took a job at Solo Cup on the south side, right off Stony Island and 95th Street. Mm. And I was working there for a while. And I remember I called home one day and I told my wife, I'm going to work a little overtime. She says, well, you know, the Tribune called. They want you to call them back. So I said, all right. I went home. I went home right away, called them. And they said that, you know, are you still interested in the job? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I went, interviewed and got hired right away. Got hired in September of 82.
I just always loved the fact that, you know, Carmel worked for 30 something years as an editor at the Tribune and the Tribune Tower, which is now luxury condos. And mm-hmm. on the other end, you were working in the Freedom Center, which is soon to be Chicago's first legal casino.
Yeah.
Fixing the printing presses.
Yeah.
You know, she's crafting the words, you're delivering them. Without Bob mm-hmm. Sarnowski, they aren't getting anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was there for 38 years till I retired in January of 2019.
Wow.
Wow. So I need to, even if nobody else cares, I always have to know this. As if we can't tell, you did grow up in the Chicago area, right? Whereabouts exactly?
South, all the way south, all the way east. You know, like Jim mentioned, you know, his wife grew up in the shadow of the steel mills. I was literally two blocks from the mill. That's where our house was, right off 79th Street and Lakeshore Drive, South Shore Drive.
Almost to Indiana. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
And, yeah. Grew up there. And I mean, we were so close to the mill that in the summer, if the wind was off the lake, my mom would have to bring the laundry in the house and we'd have to shut the windows because we get all that red ore dust everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we were really close.
So many people come to Chicago for the show, Bob, and you know, it's really easy to come to this city and forget how much of it there is. There is this South Side. There is mm-hmm. this West Side. It is not just Lakeshore Drive and the Magnificent Mile. You know, maybe they venture as far as Museum Campus, you know, but there's a lot of Chicago beyond that.
Oh yeah, that's for sure.
Well, yeah.
I was just going to say, I grew up in a small steel town. So kind of if you took Chicago and shrunk it by 500%.
Yeah.
All my family were in steel mills, and I know exactly what you mean. It's sad to me to see all of these factories go away. And I know people think that's funny, but.
It's how it is with me, my dad, my grandfather, my uncles, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a surprise that I ended up there. But at least I, you know, my dad says, I'll get you a job there, but you have to do a trade. You know, mm-hmm. my dad was in production and my grandfather. So, you know, my dad said, you know, do a trade. And my uncle who worked there was an electrician. So he says, well, you know, do that, serve an apprenticeship, you know, get your journeyman's card and then you can go anywhere you want. And they were right.
Yeah.
Well, it's great to hear you tell that story about taking Shep's painting class, Bob, because you know, I think the last painting class he did in his lifetime, you know, his eyes were gone and his hands were shaky and he had you teach it. And I took it. He sat there, piped up once in a while, napped a little bit. But it was fantastic to have you as an educator. And it's a sign of his respect for you as a painter that he would have anybody else teach the painting class. And, you know, I had read, going back to campaigns in the 80s and 90s, about the Chicago School, the Chicago School of Painting. And I asked Shep about that when I was got to know him and was doing the book with him, and he just laughed. He said, "What a pretentious phrase." He says, "I don't even know what that means. I think it's just painting with oils." But I think it's more than that. You know, it has to do with mixing colors and painting with oils. But you, your entire career as a figure painter, and there's more to Bob Sarnowski than just painting figures, but you've remained true to oils as Shep taught so many people to use them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even before I took Shep's class, I kind of dabbled in oils as a kid, you know, on canvas, and I knew that their blending capabilities. So I tried enamels, like in his book, you know, blending with thinned out paint, and I just couldn't do it. So I figured, well, I'm going to try oils on these figures. And that kind of worked for me. I was able to blend them, but I had no color theory at the time. So the colors weren't really what they should be. And then after I took Shep's class, you know, all that kind of came together because he taught us color theory, and he made sure that we only used primary colors for a while. And he says, you can probably mix up, well, not probably, he says, you can mix up any color you want using the primary colors. Mm-hmm. So he said, do this for a few years and then, you know, go ahead. Once you know how to mix your greens and your browns, he says, then you could buy like tubes of those colors to do shortcuts. So, you know, that's basically what I did for years. I just used the primary colors and kind of learned color theory that way. And yeah, till this day, I use oils. I just can't not use oils. I tried when everybody was using acrylics back when they first came out, and I just kept going back to oils. I just feel comfortable with them, so that's what I use.
Did you buy the Shep thing that all you need is five tubes of paint? I mean, our dear friend Mike Cobb had about, you know, 500. He'd love to collect tubes of oil paint.
Yeah, I actually did. I didn't use all those paint, even still, I only probably have 20 tubes of paint on my desk, you know, but yeah, I did agree with Shep. And because of that, I can pretty much mix up any color I want. You know, I can see a color. I've always been good at knowing what's involved in that color and being able to mix it up. So, yeah, I did kind of agree with Shep on that.
Do you undercoat in acrylics?
Yep.
And do you paint all of the colors in the appropriate color in acrylics and then go over it with oils?
Yeah, pretty close. Like Shep said, blue for blue, you know, if you're going to go with blue oils, put a blue undercoat, red underneath red, but, you know, not to the point where it's like certain shades. It's just basic reds and greens and whatever, yellows, whites. Yeah. But yeah, I paint with acrylics on every figure I have, and then I paint it the right way with oils.
So. You know, Bob, it may seem insultingly basic to ask you, but I think given that we now have like two generations that are familiar with acrylics, have never worked with oils, talk about the process. I mean, it's completely different than the layering approach that we take with acrylics.
Well, right. You know, we mixed up in his class, we mixed up three shades. We mixed up the base color, we mixed up a highlight color, and we mixed up a shadow color. So on a figure, you know, you could see the folds, and the top of the fold would be the highlight color. The base of the fold would be the base color, and underneath would be the shadow color. So you'd essentially lay in these three different shades of whatever color you're using and then blend those together. And you didn't really use like a sharp brush to blend them. You use kind of like a dull brush. Then you blend everything together. And it's kind of time consuming because you have these three colors. And after years and years and years of doing this, I just took a shortcut. And I just mix up two colors now, a base color and a shadow color. And then the highlight, I do wet on wet. which means as long as the oil's wet, I can add my highlight to it and kind of blend that in like that.
And the oil stays wet for quite a long time. Did you build a light box? As Shep recommended?
It depends on the shade. You know, certain shades will dry faster than others, but for the most part, you've got like a day of working time. And then, you know, once the oils are on, some of them will dry flat, some of them won't, but I always use dull coat. Tester's dull coat in an airbrush, and I just flat coat everything. Then if it requires a little bit of gloss, then I'll just use like a clear varnish and, you know, gloss the buttons and the leather and things like that.
Do you add any medium to the oil paint or turpentine or what do you think?
No, just mineral spirits.
Mineral spirits.
Okay. Yep, that's it.
That'll help them drying a little bit, huh?
Yeah. And Shep did say that if you need it to dry quicker, you put it in the oven. Mm-hmm. This was back when all the figures were white metal.
I did build a light box, you know, as he showed us in the diorama book, where you have the high watt light bulb. Doesn't work with an LED bulb, kids. You need a 100
watt. Yeah, right. You need something that puts in heat.
And I use it mainly to dry or to speed up the hardening of two part epoxy putty when I'm sculpting. Yeah. But you know, Bob, the impediments to me have even having taken your class and even, you know, when Shep insisted that I replace some of the figures that had been removed from the Victory with oils the way he did them. You know, I'm always tripped up, A, by the fluffy brush, dull brush, you called it, blending. You know, I would take it to the highlight to base line and just wind up with one color. And I was always messed up by the impatience of wanting this thing to dry. And even the light box didn't help all that much. It's a different skill, and it's more forgiving in some ways. Like you said, you got maybe a day, you know, to go in and touch to add that higher high and lower low. But you know what I'm finding really interesting, Bob, and I'd love to give you a couple tubes to play with. Everybody's excited now about the tube acrylics that Scale 75 has been making because they're super fine, unlike the stuff we buy at Blix. And so you kind of have that joy of color mixing that you get with oils, but, you know, without the waiting for a day to dry.
I do have a set of those. I bought a set of those a couple of years ago in Atlanta.
Are you digging them?
Yeah. For certain things, I guess. You know, you can, do you have a wet palette?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can apply it to a wet palette and just like mix your shades up and everything. But, you know, once I apply it on the figure, they pretty much dry like regular acrylics. And I really don't have that blending ability like I do with oils. So I use them, but I still haven't painted a figure with them. Mm-hmm. I might use them for like some highlights or deep shadows or something, but they are really good paints.
Yeah. So still with oils, what do you think of that phrase Chicago school? Was it more than just using the oils, or was it people lucky enough, whether they were in Chicago or whether Shep took the show on the road, to have had a class with Shep? Is that all that it meant?
I think the Chicago school came from Shep, right? Because Shep was based in Chicago and he taught the class. And you know, I don't know many people that used oils on figures other than he did, right? Mm. So, yeah, I think that's why it got its name from that.
Because ironically, most people were using acrylics and enamels at the time, like you said, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And even Shep in his book. His first book, he used, you know, I think he used Humbrols and maybe some testers and then blended with a brush dipped in mineral spirits. I could never do it. So I figured I would try oils, and, you know, oils work really well for me.
Classic Shep line. He liked Humbrol, but I could never get that lid back on the damn tin.
Yeah. I mean, Humbrels were decent. But he's right. After a while, that you'd have to scrape all that gunky paint off and like use a little mallet to get that tin stuck back on.
Yep, and then it would bend out of shape. I don't know how Rand does it. I don't know.
And it's pre-1990 or so Humbrels, because when they changed, they were worse than testers, I think. I don't know if you remember when they came out with the new line.
Yeah, I don't know if I've used those. No, I stopped using Humbrels in the early 80s.
So you really are a big fan of busts when it comes to painting. I mean, I think some of the most striking Bob Sarnowski pieces I've seen have been busts.
Well, that's because those are all commission pieces, and those are the things that the people, you know, they want me to paint for them.
Ah, okay. I thought maybe you just didn't like feet.
No. No, I picked up two commissions at the show, and they're both full figures, so I got to figure out how to paint legs now. So, and arms.
Yeah, how about that? Wow.
Yeah, no, but busts, you know, as you get older, busts are easier to paint to me, you know, because I can't do 54s anymore. I can't see the eyeballs. Mm. These are 75s and 80s, so they're going to be a little bit of a challenge too, but I've got a good set of mono goggles I could put on. But yeah. The bust came from the people I paint for.
Okay.
Did you seek out the collectors to paint these commissions, or did they find you?
No,
and ask you
I never sought anybody out, you know. Just word of mouth, people would be at the shows. You know, I've been fortunate to have people like my work enough to want me to paint for them. So
what do you think of the state of painting today, Bob, as a super talented painter yourself, who's really seen things progress from the 80s, you know, and being the show photographer for MMSI and being a great photographer, taking pictures at other shows too, you know, the work coming out of Europe, the work coming out of Asia, what do you think about the way that the painting has progressed?
You know, it's like you like 20 years ago, you would see a figure that would just blow your mind, right? The paint job, and you never thought you'd see anything get better than that. But it is, you know, you've got artists out there now, you know, like Jim Rice, you know, I it's just unbelievable what this guy can do. I can't paint like that. You know, I do my best, but you know, I can't paint like that. And I think he uses acrylics too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, who knows what's going to be that, you know, happen in 10 more years, you know, how can you get better than Jim Rice? You know, mm-hmm. Jason Whitman, these guys, you know, I don't know. It just baffles me.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing how you'll go through a whole decade of people painting at a certain level or a certain way, and then all of a sudden somebody just comes up with something new that you never thought would happen. And you think it's reached its pinnacle. Every 10 years I've thought that. And then it just something else happens. It's amazing.
Yeah. And he had his figure painting class and people were posting pictures online. And I guess he like starts out with black. He paints all of his faces and figures black. And, you know, at the end, when you see, you know, the final product, it's like, damn, you know, how can you just start off in black? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I don't get it. And a part of me wants to know how it works, but then a part of me doesn't, because I know what I need to do to paint, and I'd be afraid I'd want to try different things. And that's just me. I'm kind of happy with the way I paint now. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll try it one day, but I don't know. I'm a little leery to do that.
I also think it's what each individual painter enjoys. You know?
Yeah.
I dislike when everybody hops on one bandwagon and says, well, now you've got to paint like this.
Right, right. And that's kind of how when the acrylics came out years ago, everybody was like, well, you have to use acrylics now. I'm like, well, I don't like them. You know, I do use acrylics. I use acrylics on every figure, but
yeah,
then I'll put oils over it. So
do them right, as you said. That was a funny line.
Yeah. I guess.
Well, everything we go through is just a small scale version of what the art world goes through, right? I mean, you see those art movements, and the exact same thing happens.
Right.
In the late 1800s, early 1900s, if you weren't painting in the impressionistic style, then you were just like, there's no reason to even look at your stuff. And before mm-hmm. that, the impressionists were the rebels.
Right. Right.
That's true. Yeah. I teach the painted word in one of my classes, and it's Tom Wolfe's screed against all forms of modern art. And he just gets more wound up as each chapter progresses. First, he hates the impressionists, you know, and then by the time he gets to like Warhol and pop art and then photorealism, you know, Tom Wolfe thinks you should paint an apple and it should look like an apple and anything else is an art. And I just make my students read it. And at first they're like, you know, well, I guess it's in a book. It's got to be right. And I'm like, no, I read this. I make you read it so that you can argue with it the whole time.
Yeah.
So, you know, Bob, what satisfaction do you get out of painting? And I want to lead that into the second question. I just find it so inspiring that the last couple of years you've been doing some fantastic armor after. I mean, maybe you were doing it all along, but, you know, we all in the club had in our head Bob Sarnowski, great painter. And then all of a sudden we're getting Sarnowski tanks.
Well, you know, every February we do our trek down to Atlanta, right? Mm-hmm. So I drive down there with Pat, drive down there with Dan Tasanchik, Pat Fess, and another fellow, Chuck Aylshire. Well, you know, Chuck is a really, really good armor modeler. And they all three of them belong to AMPS, right? The Armor Model Preservation Society. So I really never paid any attention to that. And then I went to one of their shows. They had a show out here in South Bend a few years ago. And I'm looking at these tanks and these vehicles, and I'm like, well, you know, these are kind of nice. And I used to build tanks. I used to build airplanes as a kid. But then again, when I saw these figures, I just never went back. I didn't build a model since probably 1980. You know, just all figures up until a few years ago. So I decided to try it, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. You know, I enjoy the whole process of just sitting at the workbench and snipping pieces of plastic off the sprues and sanding them all down and gluing things together and then painting it all. You know, I watched all the YouTube videos, and I bought airbrushes and more paints, and I enjoy it. You know, it's just, it's kind of therapeutic to me. To me, it's more relaxing than figure painting.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Why is that? Is it you were coming at it as a blank slate, whereas figure painting, the new Sarnowski bust better be as good as the last one, or what?
Well, again, you know, I'm lucky enough to paint, you know, pretty much everything I paint are commission pieces. So they have to be perfect. You know, they have to be perfect because they're for people who are paying me decent money to do them. Mm-hmm. The tanks and all that, that's just for me. You know, mm-hmm. I'll do the best for me, but, you know, they're mine. Right. And if they look okay, then I'll move on to the next one.
I love
You've also gotten into 3D printing.
Yeah.
Are you still with that?
Yeah, I am. I just printed up a bunch of tools for one of the tanks I'm doing now. Mm. So, yeah, I started that about a year ago. Mm. And I really never thought I would. I just never thought I'd need to do it. But it's fun. You know, it's just another thing to learn, and I like to learn things. And I have a resin printer, which there's a pretty good learning curve on that. You just can't throw stuff on and print. Mm-hmm. But luckily YouTube's there, and there's tons of info on YouTube, and yeah, it's It's a lot of fun.
It's its own hobby, isn't it? It's not just a quick addition to the hobby. It's its own thing.
Right. And as good as these kits are now, resin parts to me are a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot more detail.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can print. It's just, it's shocking to me still after printing for a few years.
Yeah. And I think a lot of figure manufacturers might be going to resin too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Never were tempted to get into sculpting, Bob?
I did conversions back, you know, when probably in the mid-'80s, late 80s, with the white metal figures, you know, you would just hack them up, saw them up, and put them back together and fill the gaps with A and B putty. But sculpting, no, I don't have that skill. Not at all.
How do you know?
I tried.
You've never seen any.
Because of the result. there are not too many survived, believe me. That's just one thing you kind of know you don't have, right? Mm-hmm. Plus there were just too many nice figures out there for me not to want to paint.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I don't know. Conversions, a little bit here and there, but sculpting from scratch, no. Never.
What was it about the sculpting that was the most difficult for you?
Proportions, I suppose. You know, I could do an arm, I could do a leg, could not do a face. I mean, just absolutely not. You know, I still am in awe of these guys that can sculpt faces. It's just, it looked really, really bad. I mean, really bad. You know? Luckily, there was no digital photography around back when I was trying to do this, because I'd be taking, some of those would have survived, but no.
There's no record of them, huh?
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I do have one that I did sculpt. I sculpted like a Civil War bust years ago, and I do have that still. That's up in my display case. Maybe I'll show it one day, but yeah. That's 100% sculpt. That's the only thing I've ever sculpted.
You don't want to have us put it on the blog for this episode, huh?
You know what? I'll take a picture of it and send it to you, and you will say, "Well, I'm glad that guy doesn't sculpt anymore."
He was right.
He can sculpt.
I look at figures I sculpted 10 boxes ago or something, and I say, I could have the same thing to say. I'm glad that guy doesn't sculpt anymore. I'm just too stubborn to quit, and I keep trying to get better.
Yeah, well, there's nothing wrong with that. I just know me that I don't think I would get better, believe me.
That's interesting, Bob, because you are so open to learning new skills that I think other people, you know, so many people are daunted by 3D printing, right? Or so many people after a lifetime of painting figures would be daunted by doing an armor model, right? You know, and it just seems like you know what you enjoy and you know where you have aptitude, and those are the things you go after.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm smart enough to know what I shouldn't be doing,
but still, given your profession as an electrician, I'd kill to see a Bob Czarnowski box.
That's what lighting. I was going to say. Yeah, if anybody should be doing lighting, it would be you, huh?
Yeah, I guess. There's one thing wiring lights up, and then there's another thing laying them out, right?
Mm.
I think about boxes. You know, after you guys put up your box diorama website, I'm like, I was pretty inspired, and I still am. It might happen one day. I don't know. It might.
Well, that, you know, it brings us to the third great Czarnowski topic, which is photography. You know, yeah. Lighting, you know, shooting. You move from the 35 millimeter film world into digital. You've been the official, you know, MMSI show photographer for years and years and years. I think it was it grandkid being born or wedding that derailed you at World Expo?
Our World Expo?
Our World Expo. Or were
no,
you
there? I was there.
You were there shooting too. All right.
Yeah.
It's just, I think, we had so many damn exhibitors. It was you, Penny, and Andy Golden, all yes. Hands on deck.
Yeah. I it was one show. I think it was my daughter's wedding back in 2008 that maybe I didn't show up. And then it was the year I had my unexpected open heart surgery that derailed me the second time. So
yikes. Yeah. All right. But the vast majority of shows over the last 20, 30 years you've shot, yeah. What right. Have you learned in that? And I have to describe for people the pressure cooker situation. So, you know, the public leaves the show Friday night at 8:00. The judges set out to do their work, and there's never enough volunteers to run pieces from the display tables after they've been judged to Bob's photo booth in the back with your light set up, right? That's the hardest part is 100, 200, 300 trips back and forth between the tables with figures so you can shoot them. And you've only got X amount of time. You don't want to be there all night, you know. Right. What's that like?
Well, you know, all I really need are like two people to help me, because if I have any more, it's just too much, because every piece I have to look, every piece I have to focus through the camera and shoot. And then you have to write the name of the artist. You have to write the name of the piece down in a notebook. So, you know, if you have two, three people, that's good, you know, running figures back and forth. A lot of times the guys that want to do this for me want to do it so they get a really good look at the figures they choose, right? Because you normally can't pick figures up at the show,
right?
At the table. So they take the opportunity to help me out, and then kind of they could see things really up close too.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a display with four or five figures, you know, you want to try and get at least every person, at least one of their figures for the website. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't, especially Saturday exhibits. Like this last show, you know, I didn't shoot any Saturday exhibits with my camera. I shot them with the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had a lot of Saturday exhibits, and you know, the table that I used to shoot on, you know, we had to break down for exhibits.
Yeah. Yeah. We were just swamped. We had 151 yeah. exhibitors. Yeah. And that's a heck of a lot.
Right. But we try to do our best.
Oh, I think the website galleries always look fantastic, and then they become yeah. a record for history. I love mm-hmm. the fact too, that sometimes you or your runners, if there's five figures in an exhibit, sometimes they choose the one that the judges didn't choose. I like that. I like having a chance to see a different figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It would be nice. Do you remember years ago when Shep had this idea that when he would announce gold medal winners, we would put the picture up on a screen?
I do remember that.
Barry remembers it and has nightmares about it.
That was in it was in Oak Brook. We were in Oak Brook. And Pat Vess and I got a list of gold medal winners.
Mm-hmm.
And Shep sent us around to take pictures of these. So we did. And Pat gave those to Shep, who had his list. And then he organized the list, and he organized he had Pat organize the images to match his gold medal list. Well, Shep decided to run the program one more time just to double check the gold medal winner.
I know where this is going.
So, you know, the first three or four worked for whatever reason. I don't know. And then then it just went downhill from there. You know, it was just and then Shep looked at us like we fucked it up, right? And Pat says, what's he looking at us for? He's the one that ran the database two or three times afterwards and scrambled everything back up, you know? But it's a good idea to do that if you can. I think we did that at our World Expo, right?
We did it at World Expo, but the difference, Bob, if you recall, is we had a whole extra day. You know,
we had three photographers who were able to, who had helpers that were organizing all of the stuff.
Yeah.
And I helped do the photographs from, 2009 or 10 to when we stopped doing it about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And he did the exact same thing to us the first couple of years.
But it wasn't his fault, right? It was never his fault.
Yeah, it was always, he would read the sheet, which didn't match the PowerPoint. And he would skip a page and but he was Shep. You weren't allowed to, you know, get mad at him. There is a rivalry. It's undeniable. It is a friendly rivalry with MFCA. And they've had an influx, Bob, of some younger people and just more helpers. And it kind of disappoints me and Barry that they are now pulling it off where they have an image of every gold in a PowerPoint. And Barry and I tried it. It was ulcer making. It was we were pulling our hair out. We had migraines. It was really difficult. And the last couple of years, because we have so many people coming to the awards ceremony, we've just been doing the awards in the big exhibit space. And so it's an easy excuse that let us off the hook. But, you know, it's like, would I like to show a picture of every gold? I sure would as head judge. Is my life long enough to have that kind of aggravation? Well, no. And I also don't want to destroy Barry. I think it would leave him pretty much a puddle on the floor.
Well, and there's anybody who knows anything about technology listening to this knows that there are ways to do this, automated, semi-automated ways to do it. The problem is you need more than one mediocre programmer to do it for a presentation. And it's just not going to work with one person doing it. So.
Right. Right.
Well, we should put out the call right here and now, Bob. We are always looking for help on Friday night to help, trusted help, to help run you figures and or help you take notes. And we sure would love to have a person or two with great computer skills to help on the back end to take those images and help us put them into a PowerPoint.
Right.
On deadline. Yeah, that's true. But that's the thing. I mean, if we had, you know, if we had a week or two, we take all your images, we go through, we pull the goals, we'd be fine. But all this has to be done in a couple of hours before the awards presentation.
Yep.
And by the way, for MFCA, we should mention that the person who pulls the photos together and makes the presentation is Paul Tomczak. And he does an excellent job.
We had mentioned his name before. He deserves a healthy round of applause. It's a superhuman task. It really is. Now, Bob, what about the aspects of like lighting and shooting? Are you going by the old, fill light and two direct lights? I mean, I'm so busy on Friday night, I never even pay attention to your setup in the back there.
You know who Phil Kessling was or is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Phil Kessling,
mm-hmm.
He used to shoot down in Atlanta, and I think he would shoot at MFCA back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And this was before I started to really do anything with figures at shows. And he had two lights. He just had one on the right, one on the left. And it was such a simple setup. It was and his results were fantastic. So that's basically all I do. I have these clamp lights that I just incorporated onto these like sliding stands that, you know, the lights will go up and down a little bit. but it's just basically one light on the right front and one light on the left front of the figure. Mm-hmm. And then I just have like a plain gray background that just kind of sweeps from, you know, level to the background, where it's like a seamless transition. And that works for me. You know, it's the light is a temperature of 2700 kelvins. So I just set my white balance on the camera for that. And then in post-processing, I don't have to do any color balancing. Mm. You know, all that is done in camera. And then at home, I just sit down and I put everything into Adobe Lightroom. That's where I just do all my editing in there. You know, I might open up the shadows a little bit and tone down the highlights and do some cropping, but yeah, it's a simple setup. It just really is.
Mm. Not as simple as me and the iPhone.
These iPhones are crazy what they'll do.
Yeah, it is kind
and
of.
And they're great for like social media.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a serious photographer and you'd like to make prints for your wall, yeah, not so good.
No, yeah. I know. And to have that gallery each year is a fantastic record of the show, like I said. Now, but you're also shooting the boxes. And this year there was a hell of an extra challenge. We've been seeing more box dioramas at the show the last couple of years. We had a great showing of some new box dioramas. And then you had those 10 classic Shep pieces. Yep. And your photos are great. You know, those came out really good.
Those were all, that was just iPhones. That was just my iPhone. That's all that was. I took my camera, but I have a 100mm macro lens on there, you know, for figures. So that wasn't really geared to the shadow boxes.
Mm-hmm.
I tried it. It looked terrible. So I figured, well, I'm going to try the iPhone. And yeah, all those images on there of Shep's boxes are all iPhone images.
Oh, that's great. Because I don't know, I shoot the boxes as I was fixing them. I shot them as I was fixing them, and my iPhone pictures didn't come out that good.
Yeah. They should have.
Well, they should. Yeah, no, you say that, and you know, you just blend with the dull brush, and it should
That's
work,
all
Jim.
You do, blend with the dull brush. You should see all my. I never really threw a brush away. I probably have brushes from 30 years ago, and they all have their purpose, right? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I probably have 60, 70 brushes in my bin, and yeah, they all have their purpose.
I don't think I've noticed, but are you a Canon or a Nikon guy?
Nikon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just switched over to a mirrorless system.
Ooh, really?
My wife and I did a trip in Paris a few weeks ago, and I don't want to carry a big DSLR anymore. So
right.
I just switched over to all mirrorless, which is probably 2/3 of the weight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you found any disadvantages with the mirrorless compared to the SLR?
Nope.
Interesting.
No, not at all. It's quieter because you don't have a mirror that flips up and down.
Yeah.
Which enabled me to take photos in places that says no photos allowed. Yeah. I just put it at my waist and just snapped away, and you couldn't even hear anything.
Like a spy.
Yeah. Are you guys familiar with Shakespeare and Company in Paris?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Well, they have a sign in there. I don't know why it says no photos allowed, but you know, I'm like, yeah, I got a bunch of photos in there.
I took some photos in there. I don't think I saw that sign.
Yeah, there was a sign, no photos allowed. I don't know why.
Those French shops can be really grouchy. I went in to visit the Jules Verne bookstore, you know, and I was showing him pictures of my two Jules Verne box dioramas. And he was like, you know, he couldn't get me out the door quick enough. You know, I was clearly not going to buy a first edition, whatever Verne French manuscript. Therefore, I was of no use to him.
Yeah. No, I mean, we had a great time there. We didn't encounter any rude people. Everybody was so polite. I made my effort to speak French, and I think they appreciated that.
Yeah.
Nothing beats French with the South Side accent, Bob.
Right.
My bandmate Tony can do it too. He's fluent in French, and you would never expect anything smart to come out of Tony's mouth, and yet he speaks French. It sounds great.
Yeah, and apparently I have an accent because the people that I, even Americans that I would meet in Paris or, you know, anywhere else, I go, so you have an accent. And I'm like, no, I don't. You have.
Not where I'm from, yeah.
Yeah, I don't sound like I have an accent. It says, oh, my God, you have a hard Midwest accent, Chicago accent. Like, all right, I guess.
Well, that's a good thing, though. I love accent.
America's right. Getting small and boring as everybody sounds the same. I like that there's a desert accent from Mr. Biediger and a Bob accent from Bob.
Yeah, you've got your accent too, Jim.
Yeah, especially when I get cut off on the highway, I turn into my stepdad.
Yeah,
fucking douchebag comes out. What's on the workbench right now, Bob?
I've got Tamiya Panzer II that I'm doing. And I've got my commission pieces from the show. So
do you go back and forth between paint?
I don't paint figures in the summer. I don't. There's just too much stuff for me to do outside, and I have to dedicate a certain amount of time when I start a figure. You know, if I'm painting like a face, I have to dedicate a couple hours to be able to finish it. If I'm painting like some legs or a jacket, I have to dedicate a lot of time for that. So in summer, I don't have the time or patience for that. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, all my figures I'll start painting now, probably up until April.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. During the, it's a bad weather month.
Yeah.
We have plenty of in Chicago.
Yeah. Right. And I paint in the mornings. I wake up about 6:30 and make some coffee. Mm. And I'll go down into my room and I'll paint for a couple hours.
Yeah, I always find my eyes are sharpest in the morning.
I used to paint at night.
Mm.
You know, when I was working, I'd paint at night, like on my days off. But yeah, now it's in the mornings. Ever since I retired, I like to do it in the mornings.
Is it the new Panzer II or the old one? The gray, is it the C or which version?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure. But it's a nice kit. It's a Tamiya kit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tank, Barry.
I know. Yeah. If it's a nice kit, it's probably the new one.
Yeah. As nice as it is, that's the one I printed the 3D parts for, like the shovels, the wire cutters, the axes and hooks. Yeah. And it does make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you tried printing any tracks yet?
I printed some tracks, but I had to take the links into a CAD program and make the holes a bit bigger because the pins didn't fit.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of tweaking I had to do, but I never did a whole set yet. No.
Mm-hmm.
But
have you spit out any busts from the 3D printer way Barry is?
Yeah, that's what it excels at. Yeah, that's way easier to print figures.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I haven't. Pat gives me some 3D files that he wants printed, and he he sent along some horses, so I'm going to try some horses next.
Wow.
Pat Vess?
Yeah.
Who hasn't done a single painting or a model in 20 years, but talks about it?
Yeah, I know. I think he's collecting 3D parts now.
I hope you didn't rush on that job, Bob, because...
Well, it's a learning thing for me, too. I've got to figure out how to do this, so...
Oh, it's a practice on Pat's behalf.
Now, these busts, Barry, that you print, are they are they hollow or are they solid?
If they're small enough, I just print them solid. But if they're big enough to where it's going to cause suction problems, then you want to hollow them out.
So what do you do? Because the inside has still got resin in it that's not cured, right?
You always have plenty of air holes. You can cut holes in the hollowed out piece in the Cheetah Box or Lychee slicer.
Yeah.
They both have a way to cut holes. And so I'll punch like at least three holes
so it will drain well, and also so that you can cure up in there too, because you don't want to leave that uncured completely.
Right. So you have like a handheld UV light, right?
Yeah, I do that for the, and I also made a little, put a little miniature UV LED light on just a wire that I can actually put up in there too.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of free, one of the things I love is there's a project called Scan the World. Is that right? I think. And they go around scanning all the busts from art museums and that. So all these famous busts, you can just print one out. And paint if you want, or just have it. Yeah. A lot of fun.
That's pretty
cool. No copyright questions, because it's free use if it's a century old or something.
Right. And there are plenty of figures to buy the STLs for that you can print. There's so much more of that than there is the armor modeling parts.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do your prints come out, Bob, like a good resin figure? Because I've got some 3D printed stuff that I just hate the quality of the resin. It's like the worst. You know how some styrene or is just really bad, and other styrene's the best thing in the world. I've seen bad resin. Doesn't clean up. It's hard.
I haven't printed a figure or a bust yet. Mm-hmm. I just print like parts. Mm-hmm. Like this one tank that I made. I made a World War I Whippet. Right. Mm-hmm. And it came with grousers. You know what a grouser is?
Mm-hmm.
It in the kit grousers had a seam running from top to bottom, right? Running through all the hardware, through the nuts, through the bolts. It would have been a nightmare to clean up. So luckily I found a 3D printed one on Cults, mm-hmm. Cults 3D, right? So that was, I think that was a free download. I downloaded that and printed that, and it's spectacular. You know, it's just unbelievable the detail you get out of it. But the certain kind of resins, you know, I don't know enough about that yet. I'm still kind of using the resin that came with the printer. I bought it came with like a huge quart bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can get different resins to mix in. And I mean, in most cases, you don't have to do a lot of carving or whatever. You have to do a little bit of cleanup with stuff, but you can get these flexible resins that you can mix in with the other, and it will make it more like plastic or resin, the resin that we're used to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are options, and I think more and more of that stuff's going to come out. So to where it's not as big a deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's fun. Yeah.
It's fun.
The standard resin you print with is... gets so brittle, especially if you properly cure it. I've dropped figures on the ground, they've shattered like glass.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about, Barry. You saw my box in progress where I had those French cafe chairs. I had to buy, you know, two dozen of them to get seven. That didn't crumble.
Yeah. And that's from Shapeways, and the resin they use is pretty fragile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, well, because I have a limit, Bob. I don't want to, unlike Pat Vess, abusing you to be his 3D printing service. I only go to Barry when there's something, you know, I don't want to abuse his kindness. You know, he printed out that little 3D garbage truck that makes my box. And but I'm waiting till the next ask. You know, you can't just go to the friend with the printer every time. Sooner or later, he's going to say, buy your own damn printer.
Yeah, the funny thing is, you know, I'll print stuff out for my 1/35th scale tanks, and those are pretty small, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pat gives me stuff to print on for 1/72nd scale tanks.
Yeah.
You know, like periscope hoods and hooks. And to be honest with you, when I print them, I don't know if they print out right because they're too small to see.
Yeah, well, you know, and I'm not going to build them anyway. It doesn't matter, but...
I'm like, here you go.
Yeah, right. Oh man,
you're there.
See, Bob, you're you know, with the guys in our club, you know, you could just be charging them $20 a print. They don't know what's going on, and they're never going to get the skills or buy the equipment or, you know, bother to learn themselves. You could have a nice post retirement business here.
Yeah, I'll have to think about this.
We don't need Shapeways. We got Sarnowski ways. Yeah. We got to get you to teach the class again at some point, Bob, because you were a much more patient teacher than Shep.
I'm a terrible teacher.
Oh, I don't think so. I learned a lot about mixing paint when you were teaching that class, and it, you know, that still comes into use. The brush thing, I can't do. You either got the feel for it or you don't.
I suppose just like sculpting, right?
Just like sculpt. Well, that's there you go. We could swap. Yeah. I could help you sculpt, not a face, but I could help you with your sculpting a little bit. I'm just too stubborn to quit. That figure in my garbage truck box, I sculpted him like 8 times. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just hard to do a damn kid.
Is that, well, the driver is the one that's supposed to look like me, right?
Barry caught it. I didn't, you know, I put a White Sox cap on the guy. That's all that it was. But
oh, you have to take that off.
Well, he's not coming out of the cab of the truck. It's invisible. Here's the problem with doing ordnance. If you're doing figures, you know, you have to do the cockpit or the cab of the truck or the interior of the tank first, right? And then, you know, you put the figures in, and then later you find out they're completely invisible. Why did I waste all my time?
Why did you put a White Sox cap on them? That's supposed to be in New Jersey, right?
No, not really. No, there's no alleys in New Jersey.
Oh, I thought that's a picture that's supposed to be you.
It is. Well, it's me at 7 or 8 with my love of garbage trucks and garbage men.
If you had lived in Chicago, because the truck is painted Chicago color.
It is, right? Chicago, and it says Keep Chicago Clean. It's got the daily.
All right, that's why.
Yeah, I juxtaposed me at that age here.
Gotcha.
But now you're Mr. Jersey, because Bobby, your son, who's a fantastic painter and a dad, you know, I love following you discovering New Jersey on Facebook. Like, because, you know, you're getting fried clams on the boardwalk, and you're getting you're having a grand old time visiting the Jersey Shore.
We were out there last weekend for just a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice out there. It's nice where my daughter's at. Yeah,
that's fantastic. But, you know, I like Bruce Springsteen, I was born to run. I got the hell out of Jersey as soon as I could. And then, you know, for the next 40 years, whenever I called my mom, she was telling me the new 6 neighbors who had cancer. But that's no different than the east side of Chicago either. Exactly. Carmel gets that every time she talks to her mom and dad.
Yep.
I can't believe you said that you're like Bruce Springsteen. That's well, but on tape now.
So. No, I despise Bruce Springsteen from the depth core of my being. But what everybody misses is Born to Run is about getting the hell out of Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, they get that wrong.
Yeah.
Like he's celebrating the place.
I have to admit, I actually like that song.
Do you?
Yeah, but that's the only one of his I like.
Candy's Room is the only good Springsteen song.
Hmm.
In my opinion. But what do I know? I don't know nothing. Bob, it's a pleasure chatting with you. You're always so quiet, I think, and you're always working at the show. I don't know how many people. When you go to Atlanta, I heard you're a party animal.
Oh, you did? Who told you that?
Mike Cobb. We missed Mike.
Yeah.
I was going to say the other guy in the car was you, Dan, Chuck.
Yeah, Mike was my roomie when we used to go to shows. We used to go to Atlanta, MFCA.
Mm-hmm.
Now I room with Pat, so he's just as much fun.
You can confirm this rumor, because Mike would tell the story for years. Having been, in the military, Pat has this rare ability. You know, I have 17 minutes, and he can fall asleep instantly, and then like no matter where he is, no matter what he's doing.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really
that's true. We'll go in our room. And I'll start unpacking, and I hear snoring. He sat on the edge of the bed, and he laid down, you know?
I'm frankly shocked that we've been talking for an hour, and Pat hasn't called.
Yeah.
I must have offended him at the show.
I think he's working now, so.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, he's finally being productive once again.
Yeah.
The running joke, he, as you know, you listen, he just calls.
I know.
I don't know. Maybe maybe he paid Carmel $20, you know, and she tells him, okay, they're taping, get ready.
Right.
Well, thank you, Bob. And
thank you.
It's good to shine a spotlight on a self-effacing and quiet guy we don't get to talk to enough.
Yeah, well, no thanks. It was fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bob.
What a treat talking to Bob. That's probably more than I've ever heard Bob say at one place in one time.
I think so. It was great. And he's just a really easygoing, nice guy. I really like Bob.
And he puts himself, you know, he puts himself down as a teacher, but the painting class I took, you know, nominally overseen by Shep, but mostly Shep was napping. You know, Bob was teaching, Shep was napping. Once in a while, he'd get up and come over and say, no, you're not doing that right. you know, but Bob didn't say that. Bob said, Jim, I think you need to go higher on the highlights or lower in the shadows and that blending thing. So have you painted much in oils?
That's what I started off when I got serious into figure painting. That's what I started off with because that's what Shep's book said.
Yeah.
And his dioramas book. And so I got some oils and painted in oils for what, maybe 10 years or so?
Yeah.
And so I did quite a while.
You ever miss them?
Yeah. I mean, there's something about oils that is just, I don't know. I'm actually thinking about getting back into them. Jones recently got into painting some figures with oils, so she's made me want to try again. But there's something about the depth of oil paints.
Yeah.
That is just, you can't get it with acrylics. And acrylics have other advantages, but there's nothing like oils.
No, it's true. And, you know, on those occasions when I've touched up or tried to replicate Shep's figures, you know, the one that was removed from the victory box or the repairs on Abe Lincoln in Brady's studio, of course, I'm using oils. And I do love working with them, and I have a light box.
Yeah,
Carmel calls it my easy bake oven. You know,
that's what it's. It's exactly what it is.
That's exactly,
exactly
what it is.
How easy bake ovens work.
Nice square box. I think it was the first of any of the boxes I built because my first couple of boxes were all off a little bit. That 1/16th of an inch on one side or the other. But it was like the first square box. I painted the inside gray, I painted the outside green, and there it sits, and it speeds up the drying of my putty when I'm sculpting, and on the occasions when I paint oils, it speeds up the drying of the oil. But, you know, one among the 100 things I learned by restoring these Shep paint boxes was just how vibrant those colors remain 40 and 50 years later.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The figures in the Hamlet box that I just brought back, the clothing is just so incredibly nice and bright. And
yeah,
you can't get those colors with acrylics. I have not been able to, especially reds and pinks, crimsons, that kind of color.
Yeah, red, man. You know, the 7-figure box that's nearing the finish line for me, Showgirls in Paris, circa about 1970. You know, the reds and the oranges and even the lighter purples, violets, you know, it's just, I'm wishing that I did those at least in oils this time.
Yeah.
Because I am actually having to go and reprime the areas that are going to get the highest highlight. Because I'm finding that, you know, base coat with the middle tone and then 6, 7, 8, 10 attempts to feather in or layer the higher tones, and it just stays bass tone. You know?
Well, but I mean, I think that might be because of the mixes of your paint, though. Maybe you're not putting it on thick enough. Maybe you're putting two transparent layers on.
You know, it could be, but I've tried like 10 different mixes. You know, I've been using the Scale 75 tube acrylics, which are really, as I said to Bob, very close to working with oils in terms of mixing. And I've tried, you know, numerous different mixes, you know, almost like 90% yellow and 10% orange, you know, to get my high. And I've tried different yellows and I've tried, you know, different oranges and the, you know, and I've tried different oranges to bring out the high and the red. It's just been crazy.
Why orange? What is your flesh mix now if you're using those tube acrylics?
A little pinkish flesh. And then the golden flesh, and then the high, the their flesh highlight, which is a much whiter pink flesh.
Okay.
And then for the highest highlight, the very tip of the nose and the nostrils, say, I add a little white.
Okay. Try this, though. I don't know if you've tried this before, but it's actually mixing from base colors is no more difficult than doing that. In fact, I think it's easier, and it's easier to get the right tones because you're fighting, to me anyway, and an artist might say something totally different. I might be wrong about this, but the way it seems to me is when I'm starting with flesh tones, I'm starting with some complex mix that I don't know what's in it, right? And as soon as I start adding other colors, it's hard to keep the hue consistent or to get the right hue. But if you start with yellow, red, and white, and you can add a touch of blue to calm it down a little bit, to gray it out just a little bit, it's just easier for me to get the right colors.
Well, I don't think you're understanding me. I think my flesh tones are just fine. In fact, the mighty Joe Burton, twice over a span of a month, has come and looked at these figures and said, I really like your flesh tones. And he's slightly more generous with a compliment than Shep ever was. But still, to have Joe say that. No, I'm talking about, Barry, the lingerie dance costumes.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the flesh.
No, I have one woman in red and one woman in orange, and I'm talking about getting the high highlights.
I got you. You're talking about yellow and orange, I thought you were talking about flesh. Okay.
No, I was trying to bring up the orange, right? Because bring up the orange with white just it muddles it up. Yeah. It's not vibrant, right? So different yellows I've tried to tweak the orange, bring it up to the highest highlight. You know, and you know, shading red is always a nightmare because just the little bit of whatever you're going to use to shade, you can take two or three different approaches, umber or, yeah, you know, whatever. Just the littlest just makes it muddy, 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 and it just spreads all over everything if you're not careful. Yeah. So, you know.
But that's something where you can work it with a little bit of a multimedia approach, and you can add some oils as glazes or.
That's true.
You know, just some thinned oils like an alizarin crimson, which it makes a nice deep shadow for red sometimes. Mm. And you can even add a little bit of blue into that to make a dark, dark purple.
You know what I've been playing with? I was so busy running the judging as the gift that Shep gave me that never ends. You know, I think you need to be head judge now, Jim. and then he left this mortal coil. Thanks, Shep. All I got to spend my money on at this MMSI show were four different sets of inks.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I'm watching what
the inks too.
You know, because the consistency is obviously so much thinner, right, than even watered down acrylic paint, but there's a gloss to them. So especially when I'm doing ladies' stockings or elaborate hairdos, right, to mix in a little, they're acrylic inks, to mix in a little of my highest highlight paint with the ink is getting. I don't have to then mess around with gloss, which I just have this chronic problem. Either I thin the gloss out so much that it doesn't do anything, or I don't thin it out enough and then it looks unnatural. So if I don't have to use gloss anymore, I'd be happy. But I know the inks are working. I'm just beginning to play with them.
Well, and they are a little more along the lines of oil too, because they're translucent.
Yeah. Right.
And so they can add a lot of depth, and you see that with Jim Rice's work, like you said.
Yeah. All right. So the new feature, before we get into all the newsy stuff I want to talk about, is Jim's question for Barry of the episode. I have to come up with a better title for this. Jim's question, it can just be, right? Because 99% of the time when you and I talk as civilians, not in front of a microphone, I've got a list of six questions for you. I just did one, basically, about the highlighting of oranges and reds. But it's just, you know, your voluminous encyclopedic knowledge of all things in this hobby just never ceases to astound me.
No pressure. Right?
No, it isn't. I've yet to ever ask you a question that you didn't have some advice, some book, some figure that was that. Did you ever think of the X kit? No, I didn't. Okay, I didn't know there was one. It never ceases to amaze me. So here's my question for you now, and because I was frustrated this morning trying to do some of those highest highlights, how often do you swap out your brushes?
You mean as they wear out?
Yeah.
From figure to figure?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so you and I both use Winsor & Newton Series 7, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, approximately cost an arm and also half a leg.
They're not that expensive.
Well, they're not that cheap. We both have a stash, yes, of the little plastic sleeve covered brand new virgin Winsor & Newtons.
I do.
All right. And I'm always because I treasure that stash, especially because a few years ago, the Sable, you know, because of some weird European controversy over Sable hair, you couldn't get Winsor & Newton's for a couple of years there. So everybody was panicking.
It was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service thing, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? I thought it was on the import end.
No, I don't think so. I think it was a U.S. issue.
Okay. All right. But they were hard to get for a while.
Yeah, but now there might be other problems because doesn't it mostly come from Russia?
That's true, too.
So as far as how often I swap out brushes, I just pulled I think it's a double lot. I've used it so much that the writing is worn off the handle.
I have some of those, yeah.
But I can always tell it's a Series 7 because it has that perfect black lacquer on the handle.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what I mean. It's better than any brush I've seen.
That's true.
You know, there'll be people saying, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. But
you're a Grandmaster Wizard, so they shouldn't question.
Right. But it's not for my painting ability, that's for sure. I've been painting with this one for, and I know I've used it fairly often for a good 10 years.
Mm.
And keep in mind, I'm not painting 20 figures a year. I'm painting a few figures a year. So I'm not saying, you know, they last 50 figures, but I've probably used this on easily, 50 figures or
you think
something
so?
Like that as maybe my secondary brush. And then I have one I use more that is a size one. And I've probably had that been using it for maybe 5 years. So maybe let's say 20 figures.
Hmm. Mine
they,
don't.
They last
mine
a long time.
Mine don't. You know, well, yeah, but they. You're just a more meticulous person than me, because I know you are really fastidious about using the brush soap and cleaning and reshaping and pointing. And
you got to do that. Yeah.
I know. Well, how often do you do that?
How often do I clean the brush?
Yeah.
The term painting session always sounded weird to me. So that's kind of cliche. But every time I paint, when I'm done for the day, I wash it with soap, and then I repoint it, make sure it's nice and pointed, with a little bit of soap still on it.
Mm.
And it kind of keeps it, you know, stuck together in the right shape. And then when I go to paint again, I just swish it in the water a little bit to wash the soap out.
Hmm. Okay.
It lasts for a long time.
I've been noticing my brushes have been, well, you know, I'm at that stage of a project with 7 different figures, and each of them, you know, they'll sit for a week and then I'll come back and notice a tweak here, a tweak there. And I tend to clean my brushes at the end of each diorama.
Well, we might be onto something as far as why they're not lasting.
That might be. And then, you know, because my sacred stash of Series 7s, I mean,
I've bought them, they're sitting there, I should use them, right? Because nothing beats pulling a new brush out.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely
no, that's,
not.
That's right.
But I'm always like, that lingering fear that then I'll need a double aught and it won't be there at some point,
yep.
You know, and plus the
yep.
other one's sitting there right on my desk. I don't know. All right, so clean your brushes more often, Jim.
Well, let me just go into a little more detail about the brushes I was just talking about. This double aught, when it sits there, and I did not have anything shaping the point as I just pulled it out. And
mm-hmm.
so it was a little bit kind of poofy at the end. It wasn't really to a point. But I just wet it, and it went right back to its nice Series 7 point.
Because you've trained it by consistently cleaning it.
I guess you could say that. I mean, it's kind of it's shaped that way to begin with. But
yeah.
I think what I'm trying to say, though, is it is showing some signs that it's getting some wear
mm-hmm.
when it's dry, if it dries out. But yeah, when I reshape it, it's fine. But I think I really do think you have to clean it with soap every session or often. And I don't know. Other than that, I'm not sure what else I would be doing that would be any more, where I'm being any more careful than anybody else. Other than some people I've noticed will mix paint with their Series 7s. Don't mix paints with your Series 7s. Have another brush to mix.
Do you do that? A scrap brush.
Yeah.
I usually do that, but then I get all wrapped up in painting and I pay no attention and I just.
And I mean
whatever.
To make the major mixes, right? Because I will take the Series 7 and kind of add a little bit of white on my wet
palette and mix
it a little bit. Yeah.
Do that. So. Well, and you know, the other thing I've noticed is that you can pull out a zero and then you can pull out a triple aught and sometimes the zero brush has a finer point than the triple aught. And so
that's a very important point.
For all intents and purposes, don't pay attention to the numbers. Look at the points, you know.
It gives you an idea of the size of the brush, the actual, you know, belly and the, you know, the length and the overall size. But it is an important point that the point is the most important part. So,
yeah. Okay. All right,
and I have this double aught. I normally don't even use one for anything, but I just had bought this years ago before I realized, I don't really need a double aught. One will do 99% of everything. So
yeah. Well, all right. That was Jim's question for Barry for this episode.
I hope I answered it. Okay.
Yeah. Clean your brushes, you idiot. Yeah, I got it. You were very kind about that. All right. So MMSI, the 48th annual MMSI show. I just feel like since I'm, you know, me and Pat Vess, you know, have such a big role in running it, along with many other volunteers. And I do appreciate everybody who worked so hard from our club and who traveled. But I'm like, you know, I just want to hear what you have to say about it.
As usual, it was fantastic. And it's a little bit nerve-wracking to have the problem that we ended up having where the table space was running out.
Yeah.
But it, as everybody says, it's a nice problem to have. And it makes me happy that people want to come to the show. And I don't hear much negative. In fact, I haven't heard anything negative this year. There's always little problems that pop up, but everybody just seems to have had a great time and has really liked it. And that, to me, is the most important thing when I hear people saying, wow, this is great and you ought to go next year and stuff like that. So,
yeah, no, it's true. People did seem to have fun. We didn't have many screw ups with the awards. Poor Chris Marasco, we gave him a bronze and it was a gold and it was just a data entry and data checking problem and that stuff. But, you know, if it was going to happen, as I said to Chris, I'm glad it happened with someone who is a judge, you know, who knows that mistakes happen instead of somebody.
Well, it's better that it happens to him than somebody, it's their first year or something.
Yeah,
and they don't. Yeah.
No, but people, there weren't many complaints and, you know, in terms of the judgment, there's that one error, we fixed it. And you're right, we had 151 exhibitors. Last year, ordnance overflowed the areas we had and we kept. So this year we added a whole extra row and an extra judging team. And And then this year we had that problem with fantasy. Overflowed. Next year we're going to have an extra row for fantasy and an extra judging team.
Definitely.
Because both of those areas, ordnance and fantasy, are now matching historical painters in terms of just, you know, had traditionally been the most popular going back. People bought a figure and painted it, you know, circa 1969 for the MMSI. Yeah. And now I think all three areas are thriving.
Well, and that's the origin of the show, right? That's where it started. So that's what it was for a long time. And I'm really happy to see the fantasy painters showing up and the sci-fi modelers and the ordnance modelers. I love to see that stuff.
No, it's fantastic. I think it's well matched in terms of all three general areas. Yeah. I'd still like to see more fantasy open, more fantasy modelers sculpting their own stuff. But I'd still like to see more historical open too. You know, it's like a lot of people remain daunted, as even our pal Bob just said. I tried sculpting once, and he sent us that figure, and it looked great.
It's cool.
That's you know, you and I can't do much better than that. Any better than that. I can't do better.
I would have that on my shelf, no problem. I really like that figure.
I think it comes down to what he enjoys. He enjoys painting most, and good for him.
Yeah. A couple of other things, though, I should say about the show. I was really happy to see.
Please do.
Some of the participation from the other podcasts. That was cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Scott and Grant from Plastic Posse, along with Aaron Cook. And also saw Kyle from Built Sideways there, and he brought some nice stuff. And it's really cool to see people discovering the show who have never even had it on their radar before. And we had some new people from Philadelphia show up that have never been to the show, came along Dennis Levy always comes, but Jack Lynch showed up. I believe he said that was the first Chicago show.
First Chicago show, yeah.
Yeah, and Mindy Moore came out as well. She brought some great stuff, and she said she had a great time. So, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Mindy, you know, I think her primary thing has been fantasy painting, but she did an historical figure and got an award for it, did well.
a really nice one, yeah. Yeah,
really nice one.
The British, the red coat figure.
That red is hard, like I said. And we also had a bounty of, there's been years past where we've been lucky if we've had 2-3 assistants for all the judging. We had 2 assistants on every single judging team this year. People who were curious, how does the open system work? How do you guys judge in Chicago? And that's really encouraging to me, because it means that maybe someday, Barry, you and me won't have to judge. We could just have fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think it's an important thing to mention. Seriously, it's not that you're trying to get out of a job, but I think we always need to be thinking about what's coming next. Who's going to help us in the future?
Yeah.
And who we're going to bring along to take it over.
Yeah, it's true. Right? It's true. We've got to have, rare is it for me to use a sports metaphor, but we got to have not only a bench, but a deep bench.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And that's a good sports metaphor. You used the right one.
I had breakfast with Joe the other day, and I used it for Joe, and he seemed impressed. He's always shocked when I'm able to correctly deliver a sports metaphor.
Yeah.
So we did have a couple of people from the Hysterex group build for small subjects and the Fantasy Bust group build, and it was good to see that stuff on display. You brought your Hysterex in progress. I was so stressed out transporting the Shep boxes that I left the Hysterex at home.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Plus, Joe told
me a lot of work.
Joe told me it sucked, so I see he's not overly generous with the compliment. He didn't say it sucked. He's just like he did that thing that's always hard for anyone to judge. He said, "If I'd been doing this, I would have done." Right. And now you don't know if that is that a valid criticism, and does that mean what I did sucked, or can you completely dismiss it? Because when someone starts, I've said this before on our podcast, you know, Ebert told me, never trust a critic who says, if I'd been directing this movie, it's like, yeah, well, you weren't.
Yeah.
And if you should have.
I think what you're saying, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that from Joe, that's more he's trying to be nice. Right. And he's using that as a way to say it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Shep would have just said, you know, I wouldn't show this in public if I was you. You know, you're slipping here. What were you thinking? No. Whereas Joe tries to be a kinder, gentler man.
Yeah.
He is the nicest man in the world.
That's true. He is.
That's why he's friends with me, because I'm his pressure relief valve. I just say things he never would. And this little particular smile you only see when I say one of those things comes across his face.
It is fun to see.
It is fun, right? I'm not making that up. You can testify.
Yeah. So what else at the show?
It was a good show. I didn't get to spend any money. The fact that we had 10 restored Shepard Payne boxes taking up, I mean, how long was that wall? I mean, this is why we don't have to worry about room in the exhibit hall. We have plenty of room. It's not every year that we've got 10 classic box dioramas taken up, like, what was that, 30 or 40 feet?
Yeah, it was, and I forgot about that. Without those, I guess we do have enough room for expansion.
We have plenty of room.
It was...
Because that's really not going to happen again.
No, it will not. I don't think I'll be bringing the Hamlet box to MMSI again.
No, and three of the boxes went north to Canada to Daryl Audet, and two of them went south with Bill Neustadt. Dennis Levy didn't get a Shep Payne box at that auction. But yeah, no, that was the most... Shepard Payne box dioramas in one place at one time ever, even discounting some of the museum shows that happened in the 80s.
Yeah. And at this point, I think you mentioned that are there only five that we don't know exactly where they are? Or
actually, I think the list has shrunk to four, because we found out where one of them is. So there's only four Shep boxes that we don't know out of the 25 that he did.
Yeah. Not that we're trying to gobble them all up, but just knowing where they are is good.
No. I mean, you know, Joe Burton and I, as artistic executors, just would like to know that this art is in hands that will love and take care of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
But not only the Shep boxes, but there were more boxes, I think, by other people than any other show I've ever been to. Have you seen more boxes than that at a show?
I think there were just as many at MFCA this year.
Really? Not quite as many.
Maybe
one or two less.
Okay, but in terms of people doing new box dioramas, yes, absolutely. We are both thrilled. Over the last couple of years, I think it's been ever increasing. And there was, Michael Berger from the art club in Chicago did one. And there was a new Bob Bethay box and John Werwies, I think, Old West trip to the dentist. Dennis brought his too, which we've seen at previous MFCA shows. And Jack brought
Lynch,
one of his old ones. And it was great to have, right across, directly across the hall, separated by many yards of exhibits. You had Shep Payne classic boxes on one wall and a whole wall in the back of brand new box dioramas, all of which I've added to boxdioramas.com.
Yeah, which that was a really nice update, by the way. And thank you for doing that.
It's fun. It's sort of obsessive. It's like I want everybody in our end of the hobby and other people from other ends. We have some fine artists up there too, like Ingveld, who we'd interviewed. And there are people in the fine arts world that are doing this sort of stuff. But certainly every miniaturist in our plastic and resin and sculpting end of things, we want to have represented if they've done a box.
Yeah. Recently on Facebook, somebody asked a question. I think, I'm pretty sure it was on SMCG, Scale Modelers Critique Group. Somebody said, has anybody ever done lighting on a model before? And I was going to answer, and I noticed somebody already had put, hey, you got to check this site out, and they put a link to boxdiagrams.com. So
it's very good. You know, very good.
So, yeah. Yeah. Well, but my answer was yes, and I never got a response. No response, so I guess, all right.
Well, they thought you were being snarky. You could have gone a little deeper.
Yeah, but I mean, what am I going to say? You asked the question, so yeah, well, I'm going to answer it.
Yes, and for example, you know, fill in the blanks.
Yeah, that's not me. John Rosengrant, best of show for fantastic Panzer III with the crew and, you know, the soldiers standing around it. The usual John Rosengrant work, right?
Africa Corp, right? In the desert.
Yep.
No rest for the weary, he called this one. He's been enjoying those. What is that scale? 110
116th. 116th, which is a, like somewhere around 110, between 110 and 120, something like that.
That's a big-ass tank.
It is. And he had three 116 scale figures. I actually really, the one that impressed me the most was the cavalry, the 82nd Airborne on the horse.
Yeah, I agree.
He sculpted that horse.
I agree. That was, if I'd been judging that team or you'd been judging, instead we just kind of try to facilitate the judging.
I did substitute judge on that team, actually.
Oh, did you? And you wanted, what was the argument against choosing the horse?
I don't know. I don't really remember. I think some of us were on the fence about which one of those. And it was one of those situations where I didn't feel strongly enough to really argue. So I said, yeah, okay, that's a more complex diorama and all those scratch-built figures. I see what you mean.
We should explain for people who don't understand. So I'm the head judge, and I kind of give the marching orders, and I have put the teams together in advance, and I am there for any problems. And you this year were the substitute judge with a clipboard. So I think that historical open team was the great Dave Brown of Canada and John Rosengrant and John Long, plus two assistants. Yeah. And so when when the team came to John's pieces in historical open, Barry, John goes and gets a little break, and you step in and fill in on a separate sheet that he won't see which piece is going to be judged and give it a score.
Right.
So you were very versatile. You were the pinch hitter, stepping in about a dozen times for teams that had their own work.
Yeah. I think pretty much every category I had to step in at least once.
At least once. Yeah. Well, thank you for doing that. Spared me. I didn't have to actually judge a single piece this year. Deal with problems.
Not bad. Yeah. No, it was fun. You know, one other thing I just thought of, there's a guy you know there in Chicago, Chad Anderson.
Yes.
Who brought a French airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pronounced La Tacour. And the kit that he built that from is just a terrible dog, horrible fitting kit, I think, from, now I can't remember who did it. One of those limited run kits. And it was a gorgeous airplane. Did you get a chance to see that?
I did.
Beautiful job on it.
I didn't. I know we've got a picture of it. I don't even know if we posted it on the web. I have to dig that up.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was impressive. I was just, because I'd considered building that kit before and just like, nah, I don't think so, because it is a nasty kit. Really difficult. So I think that got by a lot of people, because it was a very impressive job he did on that, but it was very low-key.
You know, we're against the IPMS have a million categories approach, but like the dog you rescued would be a very good category.
Yeah, right.
Because I remember seeing Shep's Peerless Max heavy truck, a tank holder or whatever it was, right? And I remember him, like I'm interviewing him 30 years after he'd built that, and he was still saying, what a dog of a kit, what a horrible kit. You know, it was like, and like he didn't hold grudges. How could he even remember with so many pieces as he did, right? So like the dog you rescued, that would be pretty good.
Yeah. That'd be good. I should say, I don't know that the kit's that bad. It's just that I know it is very difficult to build. And mm-hmm. it's very, the fit is not all that great. You would never know that seeing that model that Chad built. Locally, our local club, I always liked this. They always had a category called silk purse out of a sow's ear.
Oh.
And that was kind of interesting to see. That was the same idea.
Wow. I like my title better. I'm usually the world's worst headline writer or titler. But
no, I do. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be good. The dog you rescued. Yeah. And what else blew you away?
A lot of great fantasy stuff, like you said. I don't know. What about you?
I don't know. I'm too busy to have any fun. I was just impressed with so much that was on those tables.
Yeah, exactly. And it sounds so stupid, but when you get back from a show, it's just so overwhelming. It's sometimes hard to pick out certain things unless something really, you know, big happens around it or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's why
it's hard to say.
You know, the scabbard went out to the mail list yesterday, and we have Bob's photos on the MMSI site, and I've updated box dioramas, and you know, it's all out there. I'm kind of more interested to hear what other people were blown away by.
I was going to say. It's
especially
almost
those sleepers, like you said about Chad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's almost as if we're not the best people to be saying what the highlights of the show, you know, were.
No, it's true. We're too close to it. Yeah. All right. Yeah, what else we got to talk about? We got to plug the...
all right. So the other thing you put off before, though, so, and I asked you, do you feel any different now? Because you were one of the Chicago medalists this year.
Rusty Nail and I, yes. Yeah, there were two Chicago medals. So.
Well, we were going to talk about Rusty, too, but... I mean,
you know... So. Yeah, I'm honored, right? But in the back of my head, I just have Shep's voice continually saying, Ray me as a modeler. Well, I don't think he's quite there yet.
I think he would say that about most modelers, though.
That could well be, but you know, I mean, to me, I feel like I'm starting out, you know, and getting better all the time. And there's so much, I look at you, you know, and there's so many things I wish, I had in my skill set that you have. I look at Joe Burton, you know, let's not even talk about like superhuman painting geniuses, Christos or somebody, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know. I got variety and imagination and stubborn persistence going for me.
Well, I mean, those boxes are pretty special too, and you know, you've done a lot along those lines. So I don't think you should sell yourself short.
Well, I have fun with
that.
It. That's for sure. I kick myself for bringing Garbage Day to MFCA, and because I should have seen what needed to be improved before I showed it for the first time. Did a lot of improvements. I think it looked much better. I got a gold at MMSI, which was nice. You know, the problem with the box is if you have one at the show and it's not your best, you know, you're not. Yeah. It's hard to have more than one, that's for sure.
But you were working with something extremely difficult with that box that made the job 100 times worse, and that is you were working with a kit that was a particular scale and you had to make the box around it.
Yeah, which is a bad thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, but what else could you do in that case? However, that is a very difficult obstacle. And so, and I can't believe you went and took some of our suggestions. I believe I was one of the people that made one of the suggestions that you actually implemented.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and Greg DeFranco said, you know, the kid's got to be sculpted better.
Yeah, yeah. So I was impressed that you went and redid a lot of that. I would never have done that. There's no way.
Really?
Once something's done for me, I don't want to mess with it again. So, yeah.
Well, I
thought the improvements really were good.
Yeah.
They really made it a lot better.
Yeah. Oh,
look, one thing I learned from seeing Shep every week for about 10 years there, you know, I'd bring him whatever was on the workbench. He'd say, you know, this, this, and this is all wrong. I'd go home, I'd tear off two arms and a leg and reprime the face. And then next week, it would only be one arm that still wasn't right. You know, but I never mind redoing stuff. I don't look, I'm not going to go to the shelf and take something I did 5 years ago and redo it.
Yeah.
But I don't consider something's done until I show it at a show. And then obviously in this case, I don't even think it was done when I showed it for the first time. So, you know, I miss having Shep. You and I trade pictures all the time of work in progress. But, you know, it's a three-dimensional art form. I keep telling you, you got to move to Chicago. I'm failing at that, but you know,
got to figure out somewhere to retire to, but I don't know if it's going to be Chicago.
Well, we, you know, I mean, if we were independently wealthy, we could try the north of Italy. We had a really good time at Stresa.
I did like Italy.
Italy was great.
That was as I said on one of those posts, that was the highlight of my show, was seeing you get the Chicago medal.
Well, thank you.
And we, like you said, we can't overlook Rusty Nail.
No.
Another incredible artist. I was actually looking through the list this year, and I thought, well, how come Rusty's not on here?
Mm-hmm.
He's a Chicago medalist. That happens every now and then, right?
Yeah.
And
you thought he already had it. Yeah.
I think a lot of people already thought he had it.
Yeah.
So that was great to see as well, and I've always loved his large scale fantasy figures. He does kind of his own thing.
Right? Yeah,
he does those weird zombies, really disgusting stuff. The one piece he had this year, I had a hard time even looking at it. But
that's how good it was. I know one thing about having to read the awards off. So I got to read Rusty's award. He comes up, and, you know, there's a picture of him, you know, with his Chicago medal and Joe Burton and Pat Vess as show chair, you know. And I called him over. I said, hey, Rusty, Fletcher would have been proud.
Yeah.
Fletcher Clement, you know, was his Shep Payne. And he was very close to Fletcher. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, you know, winning the Chicago medal for me was a little bit of a thank you from Shep, and believe me, he owes it, both for foisting me with that head judge job and for me fixing 10 of his boxes. Well, like 13, 14, if I count the others, you know, and then Fletcher, I think would have been very proud of Rusty.
Yeah, I think so. Definitely.
So what else we got to plug?
Well, I just want to make a quick mention of Musaru Cup. Haven't mentioned that for a while.
Mm.
I got the kit out. It's a little 1/72 scale ICM truck, and it is not a fun kit.
Is it a dog or sow's ear?
I don't know if it reaches the, you know, gets to sow's ear that much, but it's not necessarily a fun kit. I mean, I appreciate, you know, the people putting this on, which is it's Lightspeed Global. I think I have that right. And, the Hamilton IPMS guys up in Canada. But man, I'm rethinking my involvement in Musaru Cup.
So the idea is different podcast hosts each build the same kit.
Yeah. Yeah. Each podcast, in theory, has one of their people, a different person each time, build whatever they are given. You have no idea what it is until you get it. So if you don't decide you're going to do it next year, I think we're going to be out, because I'm going to have to, you know, slog through this one.
Well, I'm a selfish modeler. You know, I want to build the next project I've got on tap for me.
Yeah,
I could not do a commission piece. I could not do, you know.
Well, that's where I am with this. It's made me see things that way, because there's other things I'd rather do. So I'll just get it knocked out and hopefully do a good enough job that I don't embarrass myself. And
well, you know, drop a bomb on it.
That's true.
Ruined truck.
I could melt it.
Ruined truck in the desert or whatever. I don't know.
Well, I could do what I did when I was 9 years old and decided I was going to make it some battle damage, some destroyed German vehicles, and just light them on fire.
Yeah.
So it didn't work that well. There were some issues.
The guy I started modeling with, you know, around about 10 or 11 used to put firecrackers in his tanks.
Yeah, I had a brother-in-law decide he was going to do that with some of my models. He saw them a little bit differently than I did, but
yeah. I have a very bad Barry Bietiger idea, because I don't think those guys listen to our podcast. I think we're too far off, but maybe they do.
Oh, yeah.
But no,
they don't.
Yeah, they don't. So here's what you do: you take a little bass. Because it's a 72nd, right? So like basically a figure bass. And you, take some cellulose clay and you take your airbrush and you call it the truck that sank in the quicksand.
That just brings back bad memories of, modelers I've known with that same idea. So, no. Let me just say it's been done before.
I thought that was pretty witty.
It's been done before, and I didn't... Yeah, no.
You can always do the, experimental prototype truck with the invisible camouflage.
Yeah, right, the stealth truck. That's never been done, has it?
No.
So, it has. Many times.
I know. I'm just saying, your output is so much less than mine. And you agonize over it so much more that I don't see why you should build a kit you don't want to build, man.
Well, I agree, and I'm on the same page as you are right now.
All right, so. If you need me to kick their ass up in Hamilton, Canada, I will.
Yeah, well, I do have
don't
to say that what Chris is
Barry.
Doing. Well. What Chris is doing with the kit is pretty cool, and I wish I had had this idea, but he's doing a knocked-out Russian version with washing machines in it.
Oh.
It's all burnt out, so it's pretty cool.
I saw that on Facebook, and I couldn't figure out what the hell he was doing. So he often doesn't explain himself and just assumes everybody follows every post he ever makes, and since he posts 100 times a day, that's pretty difficult.
Well, I mean, I don't like to explain everything I'm doing too.
No, but you don't.
That's
post
why I answer people's questions with yes.
Yes, so, yeah. And that's why you have a podcast that's now in its 41st episode, right? Sure, exactly.
Yeah, that 12 people listen to. So,
yeah, yeah. Well, they're 12 good people. We hung out with many of them in Chicago.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Gary Baker listens. Also, that's enough for me. Pat Vett listens.
That's right. I'm a little bugged that he hasn't called you today, though. So
I know. I might have offended him. I hope not.
I don't think so. I also should mention modelpodcasts.com that lists all the other podcasts as well as ours, the modeling podcasts, or I should say a lot of the modeling podcasts are on there. So it's a good place to go. Check out some of the other podcasts.
If your modeling session is outrunning small subjects listening time and you've still got 2-3 hours worth of work and you want to listen to something else.
Plenty to listen to out there.
Yep.
And it is nice to have, it feels like you're in a model club meeting and you're just working on your model there. So, yeah, I like doing that. I was thinking about doing a topic. Let's just save that for an actual show.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a really good show. Add it to our never-ending list of ideas.
Yep, that would be good. We'll add that to the list. And it brought up another topic that's along the same line. So we're not running out of topics for shows, and we have a lot of people that we would like to talk to still.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I was going to use the baseball metaphor, but now the term just left me. They're in the
bullpen.
No,
on the roster.
Sure. We'll use that one. I wasn't thinking that one, but they're on deck.
Oh,
on deck. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Man, I think I'm getting old. So
well,
I'm forgetting all kinds of stuff like that.
It's been a long life.
Yeah. Right.
I was very encouraged at dinner. You and me and Joan and Gary Baker. You were like, I'm all inspired. I think I've got to do another project, which is so rare for me to hear from you. Because I was worrying about myself. I've been working on this little seven-figure box for quite some time. I haven't talked about it much on the podcast. I really want it to be a surprise when I finish it for MFCA. But the next project hadn't come to me. And then all of a sudden, two came to me in burst of inspiration. And I'm like equally excited about both, you know.
Yeah.
But usually it's the 8/10 of the way, which I suppose would be 4/5 of the way through the project when the next one like starts to get me excited. And now I got two. Yeah, yeah. But I never hear you talk in those terms. And I was very excited to hear you like, I'm ready now. I'm ready. I'm like, okay.
Well, I think what I needed was to hear somebody else have some really bizarre artistic ideas. And Gary did. He has some interesting ideas, and I want to see him try some of this stuff that he was talking about.
Yeah.
He was very inspirational to talk to.
Oh, he was. Really. And I love that piece he did that said he said was inspired by you. The flat figure in a like three-dimensional box or framed.
Yeah, it wasn't a flat, but it was a bust.
Oh, what was it? The art. Oh, all right.
And I could only pick out one of the artists. So that, you know, that shows how much I know.
Well, you know, I didn't realize, I didn't see it in person. I somehow missed it on the tables. I've only seen the photograph. So I thought it was flat. But it's a bust that's in a little mini box and it says, I am art. Yeah. But it also can be read as a question. Am I art?
Am I art? Yeah. It was really cool. Let's post that to the blog, even though it's out on the show page.
Yeah. It's in the scabbard as well. Yeah. But I think, I mean, that's the conversation that we were skirting with Marin last time we talked to him, and Gary and you and me have had this conversation. When does what we do become art?
Yeah.
Can it?
And there are other conversations during the show that just brought up all kinds of topics and different ways. And it's got me thinking about things and questioning some of my own thoughts on the hobby and art in general. So,
You put them on that Google Doc we have so you don't forget them. Because then I'll talk to you in a week and I'll say, what was the idea we were excited about doing next? And you'll be, did we have one?
I'll do that.
And I keep reminding you of the ideas we've come up with.
It's time to make a new document with a new list and list the people that we want to talk to.
Okay, but some don't we lose any that was on the old list because there's still some that we really wanted to get to.
Well, they'll still be there if I do have a doc. I haven't looked at it for a while, but
no, it's called Small Subjects Ideas. Yeah, I saw it this morning. All right. And there's a list of people we wanted to interview. We still want to talk to Joan and Gloria and Carmel, do the spouses episode.
How come I wouldn't be one of the spouses on the spouses episode, though?
Well, we're talking to your better half.
Okay.
You're the regular host. I talk to you all the time. I have a new feature. Jim Asks Barry, you know.
All right.
I got like 20 of these. We could do a whole episode on that. But I think it'd be better to pepper them throughout.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you're the Grandmaster Wizard. I got to keep asking you the questions.
You're the Chicago medalist, so.
Yeah, so what? He's not quite there yet. They'll give that to anybody, you know?
to put that in perspective, I heard Shep say that about quite a few people.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And because we had to sit there and get the presentation finished. As we've mentioned before, during the Chicago Medalist meeting, which I always felt like, wow, this is something I should not be listening to.
No, it's like you know, you're the Vatican is choosing the Pope, and you're not a cardinal, you're a mere stenographer, and I shouldn't be in this room.
Exactly. But we got to overhear stuff. And I remember Shep telling me, now you have to be in this room, but you can't, you know, don't listen to anything we're talking about.
Classic but, Shep. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. You were unfazed by your Grandmaster Wizard and your Chicago medal. And so am I. I'm still excited about the next project. And I still have the 40 areas I know where I got to get better. And that's why the new feature, Jim, I need to title that. I'm bad at titling, rescued dogs was an exception. So, yeah, I just, you know, I got to clean my freaking brushes. I know. Yeah, I know. See, I don't know nothing, man.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to be able to answer the questions well enough because I feel
You've
like I'm
never
falling.
Not answered a single question I've posed you on our non in front of the microphone chats.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
I will put out a call though. So one of the and then we should end this. One of the things I'm thinking of doing is a Zeppelin scene. All mm-hmm. right. Inside the gondola of the L-30, which bombed London in World War I. And I'll go against my, I don't generally do Germans because I'm just so fond of Zeppelins. Did I ever tell
that's
you?
World War I, though.
That's so. World War I. I know. Not Nazi. Anyway, yeah. So far, I'm going down the rabbit hole, and it's going to take a lot of research. So far, I'm coming up pretty empty-handed on diagrams of what the German bombing Zeppelins, the gondolas look like. There's some stuff out there. So anybody who's a Zeppelin expert who can enlighten me, I've got a couple of books on order that are coming. I need some schematics because I'm going to try 100% scratching a gondola.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I know. I know. I did look and see there was no files to print. I mean, there are for like 1/1000th scale. You know, yeah. Everybody wants to build the dirigible. I don't want to build the dirigible. I want to build the gondola and staff it.
I'll bet you'll get somebody answering with a lot of information.
You think so?
Telling you where you can get it. Yeah.
There you go.
Absolutely.
I'm looking for like L-30, which bombed St. Paul's Cathedral in the First War. Got bombed again in the Blitz. And I'm just fascinated by these things. Imagine flying over London or any major city and dropping bombs from one of these things as big as a couple of football fields.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And did I ever tell you my blimp story?
No.
This is one of the rare times as a journalist when I've abused my position to do something 100% selfish. When I was on the staff of the Jersey Journal, I've just always been fascinated by blimps, right? And when you live in New York, New Jersey, you see the thing over Giants Stadium, over Yankee Stadium, right? You know, it's getting there. You know,
so the Goodyear blimp.
The Goodyear blimp. And it took off from out in the Jersey suburbs, actually, you know, right near where the Hindenburg crashed and burned. So I call up Goodyear as I'm, you know, I, at this point I had like a weekly column or a couple of times a week. It was like Jimmy Breslin, mostly investigative and hard news reporting. But I wanted to ride in the blimp. I called up Goodyear and said, you know, I want to do a story about what it's like to ride in the blimp. And they were like, sure, let's book a date. So me and the head photographer got in the blimp. And we circled around the Statue of Liberty and Manhattan Island. And, you know, he shot, you know, 50 rolls of film because this is before drones. This is like 1986, right? Getting the aerial view of the Hudson County waterfront under development, Hoboken, Jersey City, Bayonne. And, you know, like we're nose to nose with the Statue of Liberty. And I mean, it was just fantastic experience. And, you know, it was about as big as a station wagon, right? Except it felt like a rowboat on a really calm lake. Even you wouldn't have gotten motion sick, right? I mean, you had the sense that you were moving, but not like any airplane or bus or train or any vehicle I've ever been in. It really was odd and special and kind of cool, you know? And I've always been fascinated by blimps. Like garbage trucks. Yeah. I'm reliving my youth here is what I'm via modeling.
I'm trying to think of what I was fascinated with that I could model, but I don't know. I'll have to think of something. Maybe that'll be another episode.
You like Star Wars?
Yeah, I do. I did, yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know.
Yeah, but that would be unique.
All right. You could do Don Rosengrant on the scene of Star Wars.
Controlling with the remote control. That could be a good scene, yeah.
That would be kind of neat.
Yeah.
All right. Well, everybody, thanks for listening. Barry, thank you for your kind words. And as always, we're happy to hear from you. Leave a message on our Telby account. We're paying for it. It's good to get voices on the show, besides yours and mine and Pat Vess's.
Right. Yep. See you next time.